Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome Susan Rivers, the author of the second Mrs. Hockaday, published by Algonquin Books. The second Mrs. Hockaday has been named an Indie Next pick for January 2017, as well as a Library Reads pick for January 17, and a Winter 2017 Okra pick. This is Susan's first novel. The story of Placidia Hockaday is told through a series of letters, diary entries, and inquest documents. Booklist says this galvanizing historical portrait of courage, determination, and abiding love mesmerizes and shocks. We first meet Placidia through a letter that she's writing to her first cousin Mildred, who's also sort of her best friend.
Yes.
And she's talking about this wonderful love story. And then we jump to the end, and she's in jail.
Of that first letter, yes. That was kind of a conscious decision I made. Or I don't know how conscious it was, because nothing about this book was conscious, really. I just wrote it in a fever, and I remember I was writing. When I rushed home from the library with this idea, I sat down and began to write that first letter, and a voice in my head said, "Now, end the letter and say, I won't be in jail more than another day or two," because the reader will want to know, what the heck happened to this woman, and how did she get here from there? So I was consciously sort of seeking to set up contrast from the very beginning. So you're brought into the story that way, you know, incrementally. You see this beautiful love story, you know something went wrong. So you have to read on to find out what happened to this young woman and to the man she fell in love with.
And as we go through the story, we learn that she's actually left home at age 17 with a man that she's known for 2 days.
Right. It seems crazy to us now, but in fact, you know, weddings were often preceded by fairly short courtships, especially in wartime. And that's not just with the Civil War. I mean, we see that in many wars, that men and women marry quickly in order to enjoy what time they have together before he's called away and possibly killed. But in this case, there are also other factors at work to sort of propel Placidia into a marriage with this man, aside from just the fact that she truly does feel kind of a spiritual kinship with him and he with her. As she says later to her cousin, "His heart called out to me and mine to him. It was as if our spirits had pledged themselves to each other before we actually made, you know, the commitment as people." So she's propelled towards this union with Griffith for a variety of reasons, which I don't want to give away, but there are mitigating circumstances at her home. Her father has married a second time. Placidia's mother died in childbirth with her little brother, who also died. And so she has a stepmother and a couple of step-siblings who live in Charleston mostly. She doesn't see them that often. But it's not an ideal situation at Valois, her family home. And her father reveals in this first part of the book, reveals other reasons why he would like her to marry and to be settled. He wants that settled in his own mind before too much time passes for a variety of reasons. All the circumstances sort of, you know, the stars collide to push these two together, and then they're torn apart.
And she even says at one point, she recognized that she had been waiting for her life to begin, and it bolted forward so fast she could barely hang on. And I thought that describes this 2-year period from the time that she gets married till we find out that she's in jail.
Right. I mean, like most, I think I was identifying too with my, you know, adolescent self, as most women, when you're trying to get out there and experience the world, probably still at home, and you feel like it's never going to happen for you. And then when you're finally in the world, everything happens in rapid time. So, and that's also sort of continuing the horse analogy, because she's very active young woman, and she's outdoors all the time on her pony, and that's how Griffith falls in love with her, of course, seeing her on her horse Banjo. But she makes this sort of precipitous move, but you can't actually say that she ever regrets her decision. But the 2 years then that he's called away suddenly before they had expected to have much longer leave. But his 13th South Carolina Volunteers Regiment is part of the Army of Northern Virginia, with A.P. Hill to begin with, and their corps changes command. But he's with Lee in Virginia, so he's called away. There's urgent need of him, and so she's left on her own with this 300-acre farm, the servants, quote-unquote, the enslaved African Americans, a few, there's not very many to run the farm, and this little boy, her stepson, her husband's child by his first wife. That's why it's called the second Mrs. Hockaday, because she follows the first Mrs. Hockaday, who died of typhoid fever while he was away with his regiment. And he didn't find out about it until she'd already been dead for 2 months, and comes home to try to put the farm in order, mm-hmm. to nurse his son back to health, who's barely two. And then really he wasn't looking for a wife, but he went to his distant kinsman's farm, that's her father, Quincy Fincher, to buy a mule to get his farm in order. And instead of a mule, as Catherine Cooper says at the wedding of Placidia's stepsister, she says, well, he may have come looking for a mule, but I don't think that's the half of it now. He seems to be very intent on you as well. So events sort of conspire to put them together quickly and then to tear them apart. And she has to figure out how she's going to deal with it, because she just really was not aware that society was falling apart at this point. She'd been right. too sheltered. And so when she begins to see that, you know, they're all manner of renegade, bandit, bummer, shirker, deserter, and the press gangs, the press agents, because this law was passed in March of 1863, shortly before she and Griffith married, the impressment law passed by the Confederate government in Richmond, which made it possible for them to seize livestock, crops, even slaves that they needed to build barricades or breastworks or rebuild the railroads. They could take what they needed from you under this impressment law to support the armies. And the Southerners deeply resented this. Most Southerners were fully in support of the war of secession, but they did not feel that after they'd given up their treasures, which was their husbands, their brothers, their sons, that they also then had to give up basically their livelihood, all of the food and all of the animals and their workers, essentially. But so the impressment law meant that these agents for the Confederate government could come through and take what they wanted from you at any time. I guess you got a little voucher or something, but, you know, nobody saw.
Well, or Confederate money, too, because right. she refers a couple of yes. times that they thought more of the gold.
Yes, gold was much more valuable. So, yes, it was a time when you really felt like you were in peril from just all ends of it, especially in the South, especially after Sherman began coming through Georgia in 1864. Then that just cast women and, you know, all those left at home in terror all over Georgia. And then when he told Grant, essentially made it to Savannah, Grant said, get on ships, come up here and help me with Lee in Petersburg. And Sherman said, no, we're going to come around and flank Lee, but we're going to do it by way of South Carolina because they have a debt to pay for starting this war. Sherman really held them responsible. And in many ways, I mean, the history I've read, and I visited William Gist, Governor Gist, the secessionist governor of South Carolina, his beautiful home still standing, Rose Hill in Union County in South Carolina. And he advocated hard for war. Even before Lincoln was elected, he was sending secret letters to wow. other governors, urging them to basically march on Washington. So when Sherman said, no, we're waging a battle, bringing 60,000 battle-hardened soldiers, you know, like a comb raking the bed of secessionism, everybody in South Carolina knew that, you know, it was time to run for the hills, which is what they did. So that's the environment that Placidia is trying to survive in and to keep something alive for the day that Griffith comes home, you know, that they can build together.
And I guess it was hard for me to understand. First of all, she's so young. She's got this household and slaves and everything else mm-hmm. to worry about, but she's never done any of this before. You know, she talks about two bad omens that happen when they run across the runaway slaves, and then I can't remember what the other bad omen is.
When they get back to the house, Griffith is just exhausted, they all are, and loses his temper with her horse, Banjo. Abner, who is an enslaved African American who comes with her from her home, she's basically growing up with, he's trying to send her, you know, messages through body language to back off and not to interfere, but she can't help it when she sees her brand new husband dealing roughly with her pony, and she intercedes and, you know, is not quite sure what kind of an emotion she generates in him. And that leads to a scene in the house, of course, which we'll leave for readers to discover on their own. But she's not expecting things to have this sort of element of danger ahead, sort of these signals coming to her that it's going to be a lot tougher than she thought. But the thing she does bring with her from her home, and she has grown up on a farm after all, so she's not like living in Tara or some beautiful town home in Atlanta or Macon or somewhere. She's grown up out in the country. So she has some familiarity with the chores that need to be done with the agricultural calendar, and she's not afraid of work, as she says. But you're right, she's young to be shouldering this much responsibility. But a lot of women who were left behind when their husbands went to war, on both sides of the war, but especially in the South, in the rural South, were very young. They were young. I mean, they were teenagers. So, Linda, this is the thing that interests me, of course, about historical fiction, is so much of what our ancestors all endured is unimaginable, and they had to endure it or they wouldn't be our ancestors, right? We wouldn't be here today if they hadn't found a way to endure. And yet, I think that if we were faced with greater challenges, just in terms of survival, which we don't really have to worry about anymore, you know, if we had to, I think as human beings, we would find the courage in us to do that, and we would find the resourcefulness in us to do that. I do think that when human beings are called upon for this kind of great kind of, I don't know, courage or indomitableness, they find it. And I think we have more in us that's like our ancestors than perhaps we give ourselves credit for, but we're not often, you know, called upon to do that. And I think Placidia finds it in herself. She has courage. She's not afraid. But she's afraid, perhaps, that neither she nor her husband will survive long enough, you know.
Well, and both of them endure so much. You know, he's in prison.
Yes.
She's there all alone. I don't understand why her family didn't come to her aid.
Well, what family does she have? This is one of the reasons that she left Valois. She has a stepmother who's not particularly solicitous of Placidia's needs, and she has these two sort of objectionable step-siblings, right? And she does have her Aunt Flory, who does come to Holland Creek, who pays calls upon her, who brings things she needs, who writes to her, and who tries to get letters to her. But what I also tried to sort of document in the novel is that travel was not easy in those days. Just getting from her home in Valois to Holland Creek, which I'm guessing is maybe about 30 miles as the crow flies, that takes all day, and it's an arduous journey. You know, they get there late at night after just driving the team as hard as they can. So it wouldn't be as if you would be able to come and go easily to visit, you know. It would be difficult, especially in time of war.
I keep forgetting to put that in there, you know, how difficult it was because there were all these other things going on,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the war at her back door, but all the press gangs. She doesn't
right.
receive a lot of help from the man in town, the postmaster.
Cowan. No, he's a pretty objectionable person as well. She has Mrs. Byers, her neighbor, and she has Floyd Paris, who's the solicitous, kindly, and very civilized gentleman who marries her stepsister Agnes in the first part of the novel. That's the wedding that Griffith is asked to stay over for after he's bought the mule. So Floyd Paris, even though Agnes, Placidia's stepsister, is not particularly likable, Floyd is very easy to like, and he spends as much time as he can because he has a farm not very far from Holland Creek. So when he's at his farm, Coldwater, and not in town in Lawrence, he comes to see her and to help her, and he confesses, you know, that he has feelings for her. But he's Griffith's number one suspect, of course, for the person who fathered the child that Placidia bears. But I'm not, of course, not going to spill the beans about that. You're going to have to read it to find out. But Floyd wants very much to be helpful, and he does help her as much as he can. But he can't live at Holland Creek with her. That wouldn't be right, and she wouldn't want it. So, you know, she has assistance, but it's tough. There's no doubt about it.
And at the end of our first segment, we think she's going to be hanged. And that's when I went, what? I mean, how could somebody get to this point? Because what she did was she had a child that was obviously not her husband's. As her stepsister put it, mama's baby, daddy's maybe. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't any help at all. And then the baby is dead. But we're not really sure why. But people think that she murdered the baby because right. of who might have been the father.
Right. So there's the risk that she'll be hanged, but it's much more likely it would be treated, for instance, like manslaughter, that she would be punished for it, probably imprisoned. But the concealing the death of the issue of her body is what she's charged with, which I don't think that charge exists on the South Carolina legal code anymore. But it's believed that she allowed the baby to die, in other words, that she birthed this child who obviously wasn't her husband's. She didn't want the baby, and so she caused the baby's death in some way, like exposure, leaving the baby outside so it would get cold or and have no food and die. Or some people suspect her of even more nefarious intent, that she actually strangled the baby or killed it somehow. And that's what the doctor, Dr. Gordon, who does the autopsy on the baby's remains, attempts to determine, but it can't be determined. He can't determine the manner of death of the baby, and he can't determine what race the baby is. He can tell it's a baby boy, and that's about it, because it was in the ground for about 4 months, 5 months. So there's not any strong evidence against her, but there's strong sentiment against her. And as you point out, largely because she will not tell the story. And this is what fascinated me about this character when I read about this real case in Georgia, where this young woman who was, I think, even younger than Placidia, Elizabeth Kennedy, where she was arrested and put on trial for this charge of concealing the death of the issue of her body. She refused to say anything. She was questioned and questioned, and of course her husband was furious, and he was a hothead anyway, had an anger management problem, or probably PTSD from spending 4 years in the war. And she refused to say what had happened. I mean, she must have eventually told her husband something, because they were reconciled in the real court case, and the charges must have been dropped. I haven't found the exact legal motion, but there was probably an order for dismissal, and the charges were dropped, so the trial did not go forward. And then they went home and had 7 more children together before he was murdered by a neighbor. It was not a neighborhood I would have wanted to live in. But what really gripped my imagination was reading this, that she did not speak about it. Of course, it came to me just as clear as day. She didn't speak about it because she couldn't speak about it. And she was protecting the truth. That was all she had left, you know. She had lost her sanctity. She'd come close to losing her sanity, but she was not going to lose sight of what was true. And if she could protect certain people who had come to her aid, as Mildred writes in one of her letters, by being quiet, then she would be quiet. But that she said, the truth is my creed and my salvation. I am not lying to save myself or to ease Griffith's, you know, feelings or anybody's. I am just sticking by the truth, and so I'm not going to say a word about this. And I felt, she can't tell her story in 1865, but I can tell it in 2014, 15, 16. And I just ran home with my fictional character story. She's already coming through. I could hear her voice. She was telling me the story, and I thought, ah, you know, she's getting it out finally for all those women, you know, who may have suffered a plight like this, especially Southern women who during the Civil War were really on their own. That's why desertion was so high near the end of the war when Sherman came through Georgia mm-hmm. and the men up north, especially in, you know, the ANV, the Army of Northern Virginia, when they heard what was going on, desertions just reached just an enormous level because they were so frightened for their families at home. And they were thinking, what am I doing up here? You know, fighting Grant's forces always were like twice the size of what they had left in the Confederate regiments. Why am I up here when I can't even protect my own family down there? And that's when men just left in droves. And that's why I wanted very much to include a story, fictionalized version of a story that I heard about deserters being shot in a regiment in the Army of Northern Virginia. Lee just had to, you know, draw a line. Well, a lot of the command, the generals had to draw a line and say, we have to shoot or we'll lose the whole army, because they were leaving to go back and defend their families and protect their families. So I just really wanted this woman's story to be heard, you know, this, right. this fictionalized woman, but that story of a woman who endures her own war and has to then rebuild her society, because, you know, the African Americans on her farm, they aren't going to stay there once they know that, you know, Sherman is 40 miles away. And so right. she has to come up with some other method of working with them. And she finds out there are other connections, which I don't want to give away because that's one of the more important secrets revealed in the novel. But she has to rebuild. She has to find a way not to be, you know, the missus and the slaves anymore, but to be human beings working to keep this farm alive, to keep her child alive, and to survive the war.
Do you think if she had been the typical Southern belle that the story would have been the same?
Well, you know what? I sometimes think there is no such thing as a typical Southern belle.
Okay.
I was having a talk with some folks the other night. They said, well, who mentored you? You know, how did you become a writer or something? I said, you know, it hadn't occurred to me until very recently, because I grew up in Northern California, in a little tiny town there, very similar to where I live now in South Carolina. And I realized, I just slapped myself upside the head not long ago, that the first Southerner I really knew was my high school librarian, Mary Jane. She was wild, and she was an Alabamian. And she liked me for some reason. I guess I was weird enough. And she got me to take library science from her. Mostly I sat in her office and listened to her tell stories about growing up in Alabama. And she played wild pranks on me. You would have gotten thrown out of, not only, you know, out of the school, you would have lost your job, but you would have been banned from, you know, from being teaching. Ever on a high school faculty again. And she used to have, that wasn't the word then, salons, but she would invite students she really liked to her house. Can you imagine doing that now?
No.
We would go out to her house in the woods, and I remember very vividly going out there, and she taught me to shoot. I had never held a gun in my life, and she said, you got to learn how to shoot, Susan. So she put this old Colt revolver in my hand, stood me up, and I pointed at Jeffrey Pines and just shot the bleep out of him. It was the most empowering thing. And I said to her, oh, I know how Hedda Gabler feels. And she laughed so hard, I thought she was going to wet herself, you know. And that was my first Southerner. But she's the one who taught me. And this was in the days before Steel Magnolias had been a play or a movie or anything. And she said, well, you know, she said, Susan, all Southern women are crazy. I said, oh, really? And she said, because she said, we're all schizophrenic. I don't mean to malign schizophrenics. This is what Mary Jane said to me. And she said, we're taught to be all nice and soft and pretty and refined on the outside. But on the inside, we have to be tough and mean and badass. And, you know, we've got to be able to kill a bar if we have to. So she said, that's why we're all crazy, because we don't know whether we're supposed to be soft and nice or crazy and badass. And I think that there's a certain amount of reality to that, because really the Southern Belle, that image of the Southern Belle is, I think, the outside. It's sort of like geishas in Japan, that it's a highly stylized image. mannered way of behavior, but actually it doesn't reflect what those women are like on the inside, because, you know, you scratch a Southern belle and you get a pretty tough lady.
True.
Really. So maybe this is helping to dispel the Southern belle myth, this book. I hope it will, because the Southern women I've gotten to know well are very strong ladies. You know, and when they're not crazy, very capable.
Well, I'm
but
sure.
Mary Jane was capable and crazy, so.
And you could use Placidia's learning to shoot a pistol based on your own experience.
Absolutely.
Because she had to learn to do that.
Exactly. Oh, well, you know, was it Lucian Freud, the painter, said, that's an epigraph, I think, in a Michael Ondaatje book that I loved, Divisadero, I think, and I wrote it down. He said, everything is biographical. And I believe that about writing. Everything is biographical, meaning it's not me in the story playing the main character, but every experience, image, everything people have spoken comes. And I think writers just have sort of an easier access, sort of a quick access to those things that are even deep down in memory. I know that that's true. So yes, you're absolutely right. When I wrote that scene where Floyd is teaching her to shoot, I was on the deck with Mary Jane and she was putting the Colt in my hand and having me shoot, you know. So I think everything comes from someplace that's real and, you know, experience, I think, when you write. That's how I've done it anyway. People have asked me, well, what's your advice about writing? And because most people have heard the, you know, Hemingway, I think it's actually pre-Hemingway, but the Hemingway universalized that saying, you should write what you know. But I like Henry James' advice to writers, which was, be the writer on whom nothing is wasted. And he said, spread your consciousness out like a spider's web. Then whatever comes through the spider's web, if it's good enough, it'll be caught. And then you wind it in your silken thread. But he said, put your consciousness out there and catch everything. And most of the writers I know do this variation of what I do. I keep a notebook. My smartphone just isn't right for that. I do keep a notebook and I write everything people say that has some kind of a really memorable ring to it, or an authentic, you know, or a detail. I went to a hog butchering held at Brattonsville, which is a restored plantation in McConnell's in South Carolina. They have a lot of wonderful programs, and this one, mercifully, they had shot the poor pig off-site, but they were showing how they butchered him. That was really helpful, hard to watch, but helpful. I'm using some of this in the next novel I'm writing. People around me who had grown up on farms were saying things about, you know, hogs that you have to, well, I don't know if we want to get into this, but you have to castrate a hog, or there's a certain flavor that 40% of the people can taste in the meat, in the pork. I mean, stuff like that. What it's called, the organs that all come out together, is called the pluck. Some man next to me was saying, no, that's the pluck. And I'm just writing feverishly. Well, you know, I'm not going to write a novel about hog butchering, but at some point, you're going to need to know how, you know, a hog is butchered, or when you plant corn, or, oh, one little detail, when Charlie, her stepson, is ill, and it's very, very cold that winter, and when Cleo, the servant who's taking care of Charlie, is upstairs and lifts him out of his crib, his diapers are steaming. Well, my mother had told me that when she grew up in Milwaukee and it was so cold, the winters that she remembers, smoke coming off of her when she was lifted out of her crib. So, you know, you have to put these things down. You're going to need them to give that sort of ring of authenticity to what you write, I think.
Well, you did a lot of research for this book, but the thing that was fascinating to me is the actual language that you used, because you use words that are not common usage today.
No.
Why did you decide to do that rather than write it in today's terminology, I guess?
You know, it's funny because this was the book I wrote when I knew I was not going to have a novel published.
Okay.
Yes, because I had taken 10 years to write a novel, and I had found my agent with that novel. Wonderful, woman in New York, Susan Ginsberg, and she had worked with me to cut it because it was 650 pages long. And when I told my mother about that, I said, I finished my novel. She said, oh, how many pages is it? I said, 650 pages. And she said, oh, my, I guess some people don't know when to shut up.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was good advice. I cut it. And this was in the middle of the recession. So 2008, 2009, Susan began sending it around. And I got some lovely rejection letters, but the novel did not sell. And Susan said to me, I think, she said, you are going to be one of those writers who debuts with her second novel, not with her first. Go work on that book. I remember thinking, that's not going to happen because, you know, I was teaching. I'm an adjunct, you know, English instructor, so I teach composition classes to freshmen. You do nothing but grade papers, evening, night, weekends. I had my mother with Alzheimer's in Charlotte, so I was going back and forth on I-85 constantly. I thought, this isn't going to happen. But the funny thing is, you know, when you are meant to write, writing just takes hold of you and says, now, whether or not you have time, you get by with no sleep or you do something, but you write if you need to write. And when I read about this account, I credit in the back, Hugh Daughtry was the gentleman who wrote this book that had a summary of this particular court case. I ran home thinking, I've got to write it. And the funny thing was, I think I wrote it as quickly and as intensely as I did because the pressure was off. I thought, well, you're not going to get this published. You saw how that, you know, didn't work out. So this time, just write the book you want to write. Write the book that, you know, the reader in your head wants to sit down with and read and enjoy, you know, by the fireplace on a rainy night. Don't worry about anything else, but write the book that gives you pleasure both to write and as you would enjoy it as a reader. So that's the book I wrote. And I remember thinking, I don't care if, you know, it has a lot of words that some people may want to look up in the dictionary. This is how, you know, this young woman who's precocious, who's been raised by a very educated Jeffersonian kind of Southern gentleman father and who's had tutors, would have expressed herself. And I thought, well, you're counting yourself out of the running, because that's the first thing an editor will say. We'll say, well, you're going to have to get rid of a lot of this vocabulary. And I thought, well, they'll say, a book with letters? Are you crazy? Nobody's reading letters in 2017. But the funny thing was, editors read it and did want the letters, and they did want the vocabulary. So, you know, I guess there's a lesson in there, and that is what Herman Melville said, which was, woe to the writer who seeks to please. Just please yourself. Don't worry about pleasing anybody else. You know, he certainly did that. Wrote, you know, major American novel. Died penniless, of course, but he was happy in what he had wrought, you know. So you're right. That should not have found its way into print, considering that it's not really where we're headed, you know, in terms of our society.
But it did. It's intriguing. It definitely keeps you engaged. It's one that you want to read in one sitting because you want to know what happens next.
I hope so. I hope very much.
Now, is your next one written in the same style? Because you've written plays before and now
Yes. This
epistolary style.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I'm working on that now. I was working with both a conventional third-person narrator and a first-person sort of journal-keeping on a set of old ledgers. So I'm kind of retaining that first-person immediacy. I think I like that because of, you know, the latent playwright in me wants that connection with the reader with no narrative filters. But I also see, you know, that there is also a purpose served by a conventional narrator. And this second book is about Milltown life in a upstate South Carolina textile mill. That's where I live. The town where I live used to have, I think it had as many as 3 cotton mills running at one time in the early 20th century in the teens. And that was a time of turmoil as well as, you know, productivity politically, economically, racially. It was kind of just a hurly-burly going on there, and it interests me a lot. And I have friends and neighbors in my community who have spent their lives in the mills. Now, you know, the mills are pretty much in their last incarnation, and then they're going to be out of here. But these are people who have spent 40 years in mills and, you know, are retiring out of them now, and whose families have been mill workers for generations. So even though the mills are leaving, have left, the values and the traditions and sort of the way of thinking about themselves and their place in the world has continued, has endured from this time of, you know, peak mill, sort of mill town community values and environment. It's fascinating to me, you know, because the mill workers were looked down on by all other levels of white society. They were called factory crackers, lint heads, because they were largely uneducated, largely very poor. Many of them came down out of the, you know, the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Smoky Mountains, to work in those mills in Upper Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina there. And they lived in all of these communities built by the mills, built by the mill owners.
It was very similar to the coal mining industry. Absolutely. As you bring in the workers.
Absolutely. And so, you know, they were considered sort of beyond the pale. They were outside of normal society. And in fact, when they got the vote, late 1890s, then communities actively tried to keep them out of the city limits because they did not want them as a voting bloc. Uneducated, working class, white. What does that sound like? So, you know, I'm seeing such interesting parallels between then and now as I write this book. So I am working sort of with both a conventional narrator and a first-person narrator. But I will probably not give up that need to have things come at the reader pretty immediately without a narrator sort of shuffling it and screening it for you. I'm presenting it to you.
Well, I know after reading this one, it'll be one to look forward to.
I hope so.
Susan, thank you for being with us today on Book Talk. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you today, and I wish you a lot of success in your next book.
Thank you, Linda. I'm enjoying being in Memphis again, and it was a pleasure to talk with you.
We've reached the end of our time for Book Talk today. I want to say thank you to our guest, Susan Rivers, the author of The Second Mrs. Hockaday. Susan's first novel, rich with the history of the Civil War South, explores a love clouded by separation and the secret of a child's birth and death. Those events almost cost a woman her life, but in learning those secrets, her son gains a new life, a deeper respect for his parents, and a different understanding of love. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.